On This Week in Enterprise Tech, we talked about the CDC wrestling record control back in-house and talked to Doug Howard, CEO of Ponderance, about MDR. Quiet on the set.
Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWIT.
This Week in Enterprise Tech, episode 507, recorded August 19, 2022. Are you pondering MDR?
This episode of This Week in Enterprise Tech is brought to you by Hover. Whether you're a developer, photographer, or a small business, Hover is something for you to expand your projects and get the visibility you want. Go to hover.com/twit to get 10% off your first purchase of any domain extension for the entire first year. And by IRL, original podcast from Mozilla. IRL is a show for people who build AI and people who develop tech policies. Hosted by Bridget Todd, this season of IRL looks at AI in real life. Search for IRL in your podcast player. And by userway.org. UserWay is the world's number one accessibility solution, and it's committed to enabling the fundamental human right of digital accessibility for everyone. When you're ready to make your site compliant, deciding which solution to use is an easy choice to make. Go to userway.org/twit for 30% off UserWay's AI-powered accessibility solution.
Welcome to TWIET, your weekly home for everything that matters in the world of enterprise tech. I'm Kurt Franklin, your host for today, and we have yet another great episode of TWIET for you. I'm happy to be sitting in the host chair while Mr. Lou Maresca is off on assignment, but I can't be here by myself. Fortunately, I'm joined by my close friend and close neighbor, Mr. Brian Chi. Brian, how are things down on your end of the City Beautiful?
You know, it's been great. You know, it's taking a little getting used to having a daily thunderstorm in the late afternoon in the City Beautiful, which, by the way, folks, is Orlando. But, you know, not so bad because I don't have to pay the city or whoever for water. But it just means I got to mow the lawn more often. But, you know, life is tough. But I'll tell you, one of the cool things is I've been playing around with a bunch of tiny little cameras from Moncos, spelled M-O-N-K-O-S-E. And I used one kind of like a document camera last night at the makerspace because I was teaching unshielded twisted pair termination. And they're actually pretty spectacular little cameras. And they come in HDMI and SDI version. And they have a C-mount lens. So the one that I got was $105 off Amazon. A little bit less if you buy directly from them. And it has a manual focus and manual zoom. So that's the 4K version. There's also a small square one that's a 1080. And then those work great with the HDMI going into an A10 mini. And there you go. So those are actually really nice little cameras. And for under $100 for the one that's on the screen, it's pretty cool. So if you're thinking about doing podcasting and so forth, there's two. There's one from CenterCam. That's what you're looking at me on now. It's a tiny, tiny little camera on a flexible gooseneck that actually is sitting in the middle of my screen. So I can actually read things and still look like I'm looking at the audience. And then I have a couple of the Moncos cameras so I can flip back and forth documents or small stuff. So just thought I'd share that because I know a lot of you folks are doing more and more podcasting. And USB webcams are great, but sometimes you want just a little bit more.
A little bit more is always a great thing. And speaking of that, I wasn't here last week. I was out at DEF CON and Black Hat. And one of the things that I picked up back there, you know, we've talked about challenge coins in the past. This isn't a challenge coin. It's more of a challenge poker chip. This is a poker chip from the U.S. State Department, specifically from the Rewards for Justice program of the U.S. State Department. That's a program by which they are offering a reward of up to $10 million for evidence leading to the arrest and conviction of people from outside the U.S. who try to illegally influence U.S. elections. That is typically, in their mind, done by hacking into our systems or otherwise illicitly using technology to, try to pull some strings of power that they shouldn't have. It's fascinating getting poker chips from government agents when you haven't even had to sit down and play poker with them. We've got a lot more to talk about, but before we get deeply into our show and meet an outstanding guest, let's talk about some blips. Now, if you're sitting in front of a Mac keyboard, listen up. An article on Dark Reading has detailed an expanded and enhanced malware campaign called Operation Intercept. It's aimed at Macs running on the M1 chip, and it's courtesy of our old friends, North Korea's own Lazarus Group. They're using some time-tested techniques in the new operation. And threat researchers at ESET have announced that they discovered a Mac executable camouflaged as a job description for an engineering manager position at Coinbase. According to the researchers, Lazarus actors used Brazil as the launch pad for this new malware. The root of the attack, a file called interception.dll, executes by loading three other files, PDF document with the fake Coinbase job posting, and two executables, Finder Fonts Updater.app and Safari Fonts Agent. Oh, and in case you're feeling saved by your own procrastination, the software can still attack Macs using the older Intel processors as well as the new M1 chips. So there's no joy in sitting around and waiting. Now, interception, as we're told, been studied by ESET for the last 3 years. Originally a very tightly targeted program thrown against aerospace companies, it's now being used against a much broader range of potential victims. Those victims find themselves the proud owner of a brand new data logger and business email compromise engine. As is often the case, North Korea is after data, and specifically data that might be used for exfiltrating critical infrastructure files, critical defense files, and cryptocurrency. Fortunately, all is not lost. Last week, Apple revoked the certificate that would enable the malware to execute after ESET alerted the company of the campaign. So now, if you're running computers with macOS Catalina version 10.15 or later, you're protected, assuming you use at least basic cybersecurity awareness.
Well, this one you may have never heard about. The courts have ruled that the FCC is allowed to reassign the 5.9 gigahertz bandwidth, killing a protocol called V2X, something you probably never heard of. Well, V2X is basically vehicle to anything, and I call it the technology no one knew about. Vehicle to anything was supposed to allow for vehicles to communicate to roadways, toll booths, and other vehicles, and was supposed to happen in the 5.9 gigahertz frequency range, and then nothing. Well, the Ars Technical article goes on and says the frequency set aside happened back in 1999 with the hopes that it could be used to alert vehicles of dangers, and the plan was to use what's called DSRC, dedicated short-range radio communications, to actually power the system. Well, it's 20 years later, and your car still doesn't have a way to talk to DSRC. And with no installed user base, the FCC finally decided to reallocate the 45 megahertz swath from 5.850 to 5.952 gigahertz and gave it to the folks in the Wi-Fi world. Well, the Intelligent Transportation Society of America and the American Association of State Highways and various other transportation officials have all tried to prevent this move. But according to the ARS, the Ars Technical article, the legal challenge is over as of last week. In a too little, too late arena, Qualcomm did debut a CV2X, so, you know, chipset a couple years ago, but apparently automotive designers didn't move on it. So the science fiction world of cars talking to the highways will have to happen over some sort of other wireless technologies instead of a dedicated frequency band.
So where should you spend your time if you're on the security team? Which bugs and exploits will come back to bite you? Now, there are a couple of ways to figure out just how bad a vulnerability really is. One is looking at the consequences of the exploit, how bad the damage could be if it's exploited. The other is to look at how easy the vulnerability is to exploit in the first place. Dark Reading has reported that a team of university researchers has created a model for predicting which vulnerabilities will likely result in a functional exploit using machine learning trained on data from more than 24 sources. The expected exploitability metric can catch 60% of the vulnerabilities that will have functional exploits with a prediction accuracy of 86%. For those who aren't deep into this sort of thing, that's pretty darn good. One use of the model is to allow companies to focus their energies on patching vulnerabilities that can be realistically exploited. Another is to allow cyber insurance companies to work with their customers to realistically post risk numbers for systems that are slow to be patched. Many of the earlier attempts to figure out exploitability relied on human analysts to make the call, but the expected exploitability metric can be completely automated. The researchers used information on nearly 103,000 vulnerabilities, then compared that with the 48,709 proofs of concept collected from three public repositories, ExploitDB, BugTrack, and Vulners, that represented exploits for 21,849 of the distinct vulnerabilities. They then refined that information with the knowledge that proofs of concept often just trigger a reboot or a crash. They don't do any genuine harm, and they can't reasonably be weaponized. So the final model aims for a realistic picture of a vulnerability's danger to the organization and particularly might provide a realistic waypoint in the company's roadmap to effective, both functionally and cost, remediation.
All right, so this is yet another Ars Technical article, and some of you aren't going to like it. I'm sorry, but I'm going to try and stay with as much of the facts as possible and less opinion. But the CDC is going to be taking back the control of U.S. hospital data after then-President Trump seized the reporting of COVID statistics away from the CDC into a private company. Well, so this December, so this coming December, the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention will finally regain control of the national COVID-19 hospital data, which the agency abruptly lost early in the pandemic to an inexperienced private company with ties to then-President Donald Trump. My key takeaway from this Ars Technical article is that teletracking had the ties to the President Trump and had little or no experience in handling multi-level national database containing vast quantities of health information. The number of fingers being pointed in both directions is staggering, but the bottom line is that teletracking's contract ends December 31st, and according to the Ars Technical article, will not be renewed, and hospital data will again be reported directly to the CDC. Well, my comment is that I was briefed on reporting standards and procedures during some joint pandemic exercises over the years. And while cumbersome, the error checking procedures were more than appropriate, and the difficulties complained about by the Trump administration administrators are looking more like their unfamiliarity with modern data management systems. Oh, and by the way, the article also points out that teletracking was awarded the contract and renewals without a bidding process, which if I had done that as a contracting officer, I would have had some jail time.
Well, that's it for the blips. We have bites and more coming up. But before we do, it's time to hear from Lou, who has a great sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech to tell us all about.
Thank you, guys. We'll get you back to your enterprise and IT news in just a moment. But before we do have to thank a really great sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech, and that's Hover. It's time to make plans and let Hover help you achieve them. If you're a blogger, creating a portfolio, building an online store, or just want to make a more memorable redirect to your LinkedIn page, Hover has the best domain names and email addresses just for you. Email at your domain name is key to connecting with customers and building trust for your brand. They have domain-based emails for all of your needs, small or large. It's easy to set up. You can add as many mailboxes to your domain as you need. When your domain renews, your mailboxes will too. Now, the prices are unbeatable. Their most popular mailbox is a no-brainer solution for business owners. Get access from anywhere. Use your email app you're already comfortable with. If apps aren't your thing, their webmail can be accessed from anywhere. Personally, I really love Hover's ease of use. They have a huge collection of TLDs, plus super easy to transfer. That's why they make your life a lot easier. If you've already tried to transfer using some of the other guys, it's always a headache. Hover makes it easy. Hover isn't here to upsell you on stuff you don't need. They just want to help. They have pro-level tools. They have powerful domain and email management tools that are intuitive and easy to use, whether you're a web pro or just getting started. Plus, private and secure with Whois privacy protection included with your domain purchase. Your private information will remain just that, private. It's a great way to reduce spam and protect yourself from unwanted solicitations. Hover Connect lets you pick the service you want to use to build and host your website. Connect helps you start using your domain name with just a couple clicks. At Hover, you're a customer and not a source of data. Take back control of your data with reliable, track-free email. Hover is trusted by hundreds of thousands of customers who use their domain names and email to turn their ideas into a reality. Whether you're a developer, photographer, or a small business, Hover has something for you to expand your projects and get the visibility you want. Go to hover.com/twit to get 10% off your first purchase of any domain extension for the entire first year. That's hover.com/twit for 10% off your domain extension for a full year. And we thank Hover for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Back to you guys.
Thank you, Lou. We appreciate it. We'll be hearing from Lou again later on in this episode. Well, it's now time for the bites and for a topic that is getting a lot more attention, and that is skills among the workforce. When you look at the cybersecurity workforce, one of the things that is obviously true and that no one argues with is that we have a dramatic and critical shortage in skilled cybersecurity professionals. In 2021, according to the article that was just on the screen from Dark Reading, there were some 400,000 fewer trained cybersecurity professionals than were needed in the field. A few years ago, when I talked to the folks at one of the major training organizations, ISC Squared, they listed 400,000. The article, my mistake, says 500,000. And a recent report from the White House uses the number 700,000. So whether you pick one of these numbers or another, they're all big numbers. There's a huge gap. And furthermore, we know because of studies like one done by Pluralsight that even among the trained cybersecurity professionals already in the field, there is a skills gap. So the issue isn't merely bringing people into the field, it's keeping people in the field up to date with their skills and their knowledge. So how do you do that? Well, one answer would be just to fire everybody on a regular basis and hire new people. That has some problems. We'll go with cost being a huge one. If you've never had to hire a professional IT person, and especially a professional cybersecurity person, let me tell you, it's an expensive undertaking because not only do you have to figure out what their salary is going to be, but you're going to pay, on average, about 50% of that salary just to get them hired. Another option is to say, I'm not going to hire people at all. I'm just going to bring in a partner like an MSSP, Managed Security Service Provider, and let them handle it all. I wash my hands of skills and training. There are problems with that. A third option is to train your own workforce. In other words, provide the training to keep your currently employed cybersecurity professionals up to date on their skills, and perhaps even provide training for people who are not yet members of your cybersecurity team. So what do you have to do if you want to train these professionals? It's good for me that we're doing this. I'm in the middle of some research on all this. Some of the critical things are provide the right resources. In other words, if you're going to train people, you have to provide them with training materials. That can be a course. It can be online classes. It can be old-fashioned paper materials. There are all kinds of ways to do it. But you can provide them with materials and methodologies that meet their needs. Next is provide continuous learning opportunities. This idea of continuous learning is one that we're seeing more and more in all aspects of IT. The critical fact here is that training is not a one-time thing. No, we grew up thinking that once we were out of high school, or perhaps once we were out of university, that our training was over. We were then ready to go out and be grown-ups and be professionals, never to be trained again. We now know that the fact that our markets and our technologies move so rapidly mean that training is a constant thing. We must make training opportunities available constantly. And finally, we have to have a culture in which learning is appreciated. You know, if we have a culture where every time someone takes an hour, half a day to up their skills, they're hit by managers asking them why they were slacking off their real job, you're not going to get an improvement in skills. So there are lots of ways to make up for the lack of skills, but perhaps the most important thing to do is make sure that your company's gap is as small as possible because you're always training. Now, Brian, I know that you have been part of education for much of your career. You know, what do you think about this idea of continuous re-education?
You know, I've actually seen a couple of attitudes. I've had some good, I've had some bad. I've worked for organizations where if you wanted to upskill, there's a good chance they're going to say, well, that obviously means you want to move jobs. And, oh, by the way, here's the door. And actually some very, very large corporations still have this attitude. And interestingly enough, sadly, quite a few military commands still have this attitude. It all depends on who's in the power seat. So if you want to try and save money, because that's really what it comes down to, hiring new people is expensive. Training people to be able to handle a little bit more and then rewarding them for the initiative to upskill is by far cheaper than having to hire new. Obviously, we're going to be talking to a guest about a middle ground. I like the model where you upskill some and you outsource some and strike some sort of balance. There needs to be a reward system. Sticks don't work. I've been forced to use the stick methodology in a couple of organizations. Carrots work so much better. You know, just look at this. one of my favorite examples of acknowledging the talent that you have internal is when Frito-Lay Corporation ran a contest within their employees on suggesting new flavors for their potato chips. And a custodian, the guy that mopped the floor at night, came up with their best-selling flavor called Cheetos Flamin'. He's now management. That's a beautiful example of promoting from within and recognizing that everyone has talent if you give them a chance. So that's one of the things I like, you know, saying, you know, we have some good stuff. And as far as resources, I'm going to actually plug one of our sponsors. It's IT Pro TV. I've actually used that to upskill myself on certain things, and the system's great. Their education material has been spectacular, and the reporting features are kind of neat because it'll actually give you reporting on who's going through the material, how long they took on it, and things like that, so that you can go and customize the resources for your employees. It's a good way of doing things. You know, Kurt, I think we ought to talk a little bit about the balance. You know, we need people, but we aren't always going to have enough. Maybe outsourcing and balancing that with upskilling is a better answer if you, you know, want to talk about that.
Well, I think that it can be. And I think the key for organizations is recognizing the best use case for each one. I think for most general cybersecurity or IT in general, that having well-trained employees is critical because your own employees have the greatest opportunity to understand the business use and the business case. And we all know that integrating cybersecurity within the business is critical for success. With that said, there are always going to be cases where there is one thing, there's a specific threat, there's a specific need, where you have to go to an outside provider as the most cost-effective and most time-effective way to solve the problem. And for many organizations, we're seeing now, they're looking at how their security is put together and saying, what I really need is basically a layer of interface employees, people who understand cybersecurity and understand my business, who can then be critical in managing the relationship with outside service providers. That can work too. You know, it all comes down to exactly how you want to define things that are critical to your business and how you want to invest your company's money. Whether you follow the model of we invest only in our primary lines of business, basically those things that bring us revenue and service our customers, or whether you take the view that you want to do things that support those big functions. A valid business case can be made for either. And the important thing is if you do go with a partner, make sure that it's a partner who you trust. Make sure that it's a partner who is able to do the job. And make sure that you are managing that partner internally with people who understand how the security meets the needs of the business. Brian, do you have anything to add to that before we move along to our next section?
No, I'm just giggling at all the comments in the chat room about flaming Cheetos. I knew they were going to have fun with this. I just think it's one of the most amazing examples on using your internal talent, because the people inside your company know your product line or your service better than someone from the outside. You know, I'm not saying it's bad. I'm just saying one of the things that I experienced with the federal government is we weren't allowed to hire. You know, human resource is very expensive. And what we also had a really tough time keeping talent, especially when you start dealing with military, because the military will rotate out. So I'm constantly spending on training. So I had to balance using contractors and internal. And for me, it worked pretty well. I don't recommend it for everyone, you know, but having the ability to draw upon a pool of training material was actually really good. And being able to upskill my workers meant I didn't lose all that internal knowledge, which was really great. So it's the answer isn't going to be a straight black or white. There's going to be a lot of introspection. Take a good hard look at what your people do or don't do. But the big recommendations from this article was providing the right resources, create the continuous learning opportunities for your people. And I strongly support using carrots rather than sticks and actually go and work on creating a culture of learning. So lots of good suggestions in this article, and good luck, everybody.
Sounds good. Well, that's going to do it for our one and only bite. It's time to move on to our guest, who, oddly enough, is in a company that meets one of the things we talked about, managed detection and response. We're going to talk about what that is, who our guest is, and much more right after Lou Maresca tells us about another fabulous This Week in Enterprise Tech sponsor.
Well, thank you, guys. I will get you back to your enterprise and IT news in just a moment. But before we do have to thank another great sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech, and that's IRL, an original podcast from Mozilla. Now, IRL is a show for people who build AI and people who develop tech policies. Hosted by Bridget Todd, this season of IRL looks at AI in real life. Who can AI help? Who can it harm? The show features fascinating conversations with people who are working to build more trustworthy AI. For example, there's an episode about how our world is mapped with AI. That's right. The data that's missing from those maps tells as much of a story as the maps themselves. You'll hear all about the people who are working to fill in those gaps and take control of the data. There's also another episode about gig workers who depend on apps for their livelihood. It looks at how they're pushing back against algorithms that control how much they get paid and seeking new ways to gain power over data to create better working conditions. For political junkies, there are episodes about the role that AI plays when it comes to the spread of misinformation and hate speech around elections. Huge concern for democracies around the world. Now, I really like the season 4, episode 1, checking out online shopping. They talk about the hidden costs of shopping online and offline. What are you actually giving up? In fact, Meta Brown, a data scientist from Amazon, is on the show and talks about what happens when you make an online purchase. This may shock you. Super compelling episode. Definitely check it out. Search for IRL in your podcast player. We'll also include a link in the show notes. My thanks to IRL for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Back to you guys.
Thanks, Lou. We appreciate that. We'll hear from you at least one more time before this episode's over. Well, it's now time for our guest, which, if you ask the host, is always the best part of This Week in Enterprise Tech. And this week, our guest is Doug Howard, CEO of Ponderance. Now, Ponderance is an MDR company. That's Managed Detection and Response. We're going to get into what that is and why it matters in a moment. But Doug, welcome to This Week in Enterprise Tech.
Thanks, Curtis. Thanks for having me.
It is a great pleasure. Now, one of the things that our listeners and viewers always love is to hear how our guests got to be where they are, the origin story, if you will. So can you walk us through the path that you took from your humble beginnings to the CEO's chair at Ponderance?
Yeah, so I'll try to make this as short as possible, but the long story is I enjoyed tech like a lot of people in the industry. wanted to do something, lived in a really small town, literally 1,100 people, and didn't really have a path. You know, I could obviously go the educational route, go to college, and then kind of work from there. But a few of my friends had gone in the military, so I followed that track, went in the U.S. Air Force, worked at the Pentagon, Cheyenne Mountain, Israel, a few other stations, and ultimately took that skill, which really pointed me toward cyber, and then specifically into IT security, which was still relatively early at the time. And was able to turn that into a career, you know, call it a bit of an accidental path, wasn't intentional from the very beginning, but, you know, followed the passion, followed the track that allowed for me to be able to take that passion and ultimately make a complete career around it. And, you know, timing is everything. And so obviously a combination of cyber and the threats in the world continued to grow, leveraged that in the military and then ultimately in the commercial world.
Very good. Well, we're happy to see you here. Now, Ponderance is an MDR company, Managed Detection and Response. Can you briefly tell us what Managed Detection and Response is? What does that three-letter acronym really mean?
Yeah, you mentioned earlier MSSP, Managed Security Service Provider, and what has evolved, and you know, some of this is analysts driving the distinction between different classes of service providers in the security space, is originally MSSPs were oriented around primarily logs. And so ability to collect logs, be able to do some analysis. And there wasn't a lot of what I'll call deterministic confirmation that something that you provided to the customer as a service provider was ultimately something that was critical and that they had to take action on. And so over time, what has originated from that is, hey, look, you need to have multiple sources of view into the customer's environment to provide a good and correct analysis of what is happening in the customer environment. So not just firewall logs, not just server logs, but more elements around what is happening on the server, more elements of what's happening outside of the customer environment, more relevance of what is contextual in the customer environment. So what systems are important, ultimately what vulnerabilities exist in those areas, and so forth, and pull that together in a much more concerted effort that allows you to tell customers what threats they really should look at that particular time, not just a lot of IT noise within the customer's environment. And so that has led to a combination of network visibility, endpoint visibility, the current log structures that you referred to earlier on, kind of the legacy MSSP space, and the ability to actually respond. So not only have the service providers in the space, such as ourselves, able to give you more concise, more precise information about what you need to do, but we can actually respond on the customer's behalf through the technology capabilities that we have access to in the customer print. So let's not just wake up the customer at 2 a.m. in the morning and say, hey, you need to do these things. Rather, let's do those for them. And ultimately, that way, when they come in and do their normal job, they don't have to, you know, deal with the fact that they were woken up multiple times over a, you know, a 2 a.m. event that easily could have been blocked at a firewall or at the EDR being the endpoint itself.
All right. You mentioned your customers a couple of times. We're going to talk about those customers in just a minute. But before we do, one of the questions that I often have is, when you engage with customers, do you see yourself being part of their security solution or their security solution?
Yeah, that's the contextual awareness that you really need to understand. And so ultimately, at the end of the day, the customer has to own the responsibility of their security program. That said, you know, the smaller the customer, the less likely they are sophisticated enough to be able to have the personnel on the team to be able to actually provide what I'll call, you know, continuous value in that scenario. And so as we, you know, if you look at our customer base, you know, 80% are customers that don't have CISOs. 80% are customers that have, you know, developing IT security programs, whereas the 20, 30% of those clients ultimately are more sophisticated, larger, have a CISO on staff, have a security team on staff, and we augment their capabilities. So the objective of any MDR player is ultimately understand what the customer's objectives are from a security perspective, understand their IT environment, understand what their crown jewels are from an IT asset value perspective, from a data perspective, what are their regulatory risk, what are their revenue risk, their mission risk, and ultimately, are there any elements that are connected into a environment that could provide human health impact as well? So, you know, death because you're connected to a healthcare device that could impact the human life obviously would be one of those most critical things, autonomous vehicles, those types of things. So there's a spectrum. So you want to get to a point in a relationship with a client that they're making the strategic decisions on what they need as a business, and ultimately, as they continue to mature, make some more technology decisions and start running some of those programs, especially from a regulatory perspective. But in the reality of the world, you know, most customers do not have the security expertise to do a lot of that. And so our objective is to be able to provide that advisory at every touch point for those smaller clients, and then be able to support those larger clients.
I like the sound of that, because I'll be honest, I come from families that own their own business. I have lived in the world of small business for a fair chunk of my life. But here's a question for you. Now, you're talking about organizations that don't have a dedicated security staff. And to be honest, that's how I have defined SMB in the security context for a long time. If a company wasn't big enough to have a dedicated security staff or even a dedicated security person, but was instilled doing security as part of general IT, then it was a small business.
Right.
But from an organizational size standpoint, how small is too small? I mean, I have talked to companies who defined, you know, a small business from their perspective was any company that was turning over less than $50 million a year. You know, how do you define the small business that is still an organization that you can work with?
Yeah, so we have segmentation based on industry, segmentation based on the client size, number of people, revenue, and various other things that we look at. That said, we also have a growing number of clients that are extremely small. So I will call them startups of the truest nature, 5-10 employees. We have franchises that sometimes are only a couple people. You have financial services that, you know, maybe are on the brokerage side, and there's new SEC regulations that are coming out on all of these areas that ultimately drive every organization to have a level of security. Now, used to, the industry would say, you want to be able to provide a Fortune 500 level of security to a smaller client. And I think sometimes clients would get confused that what that means is that you're having to have all the sophistication in your infrastructure, all the sophistication from a people perspective to be able to provide that level of security. And the reality is the smaller number of clients that probably don't even have firewalls, don't even have much of an IT infrastructure, especially post-COVID where they're working from home, those environments are going to be oriented around two aspects. Obviously, the endpoint, the PC that they're working on, and maybe some SaaS services that they acquire, such as Office 365, Salesforce, those types of applications. And in those environments, it can be extremely cost effective, even for an MDR provider to provide those. So, you know, you're thinking of, you know, sub-$1,000 a year to provide what I'll call a high level of security appropriate for that size organization versus maybe tens or hundreds of thousands of dollars for a much larger organization that have full suites of security products. Because don't forget that a PC with EDR has a level of security that probably wouldn't have existed 5 years ago that is now standalone, independent from having a firewall, IT infrastructure, you know, all of those things. So, you know, integrated approach that really protects a desktop of a small organization with, call it, you know, no office and five or six people is absolutely attainable with an outsourced service provider and the underlying EDR type of technologies that really protect that endpoint, as well as take sources from those SaaS applications that are hosted that support them.
Doug Howard, CEO of Ponderance, is talking with us about MDR, and we're getting some great answers and some intriguing possibilities for who the customers can be. But before I can be joined by my co-host, Brian Chi, to ask some more questions, we need to hear one more time from Mr. Lou Maresca about another fabulous This Week in Enterprise Tech sponsor.
Thank you, guys. I'll get you back to your enterprise and IT news in just a moment. But before we do have to thank another great sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech, and that's userway.org. Now, for every website, without exception, it needs to be accessible. UserWay's incredible AI-powered solution tirelessly enforces the hundreds of WCAG guidelines that are out there. In a matter of seconds, UserWay AI can achieve more than what an entire team of developers can do in months. At first, it may seem overwhelming to make your website accessible, but UserWay solutions make it simple, easy, and even cost-effective. You can even use their free scanning tool to see if your website is actually ADA compliant as well. Now, if you're an enterprise-level website with thousands of web pages out there, UserWay offers a managed solution where their team can handle everything for you. UserWay's AI and the machine learning solution powers accessibility for over a million websites trusted by Coca-Cola, Disney, eBay, FedEx, and many more leading brands out there. Now, UserWay is making its best-in-class enterprise-level accessibility tools available to small and medium-sized businesses as well. You can get started today for as little as $49 a month on UserWay's monthly plan. Your company can be ADA compliant, reach more customers, and even build loyalty. And remember, you'll get 30% off. There are a billion people in the world with disabilities. That's roughly 13% of the population that you don't want to lose as potential customers because you're not compliant. Think about it. By not being compliant, fines and revenue loss will cost you so much more. UserWay is the leading accessibility solution in the market today with a market share of 61%, the biggest in the world. For years, UserWay has been on the cutting edge, creating innovative accessibility technologies that push the envelope of what's possible with AI, machine learning, and computer vision. UserWay's AI automatically fixes violations at the code level, and here are some of the things it can actually do. It can auto-generate image alts. It writes image descriptions for you, remediates complex nav menus, and ensures that all pop-ups are accessible. It fixes vague link violations and any broken links that are out there. Ensures your website makes use of accessible colors while remaining true to your brand. And UserWay gives you a detailed report of all the violations that were fixed on your website. UserWay is platform agnostic and integrates seamlessly with WordPress, Shopify, Wix, Sitecore, SharePoint, and many more. Let UserWay help your business meet its compliance goals and improve the experience for your users. The voice of Siri, Susan Bennett, has a message about UserWay.
Hi, I'm Susan Bennett, the original voice of Siri. You won't hear me say something like this too often. I'm sorry, I don't understand what you're looking for. But every day, that's what the internet is like for millions of people with disabilities. UserWay fixes all of that with just one line of code.
UserWay can make any website accessible and ADA compliant. With UserWay, everyone who visits your site can browse seamlessly and customize it to fit their needs. It's also a perfect way to showcase your brand's commitment to millions of people with disabilities. Go to userway.org/twit and get 30% off UserWay's AI-powered accessibility solution. Book a short call and get their accessibility guide. UserWay, making the internet accessible for everyone. Visit userway.org/twit today. And we thank UserWay for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Back to you guys.
Thanks, Lou. We appreciate it. And I think it's time for me to stop talking quite so much. Brian, I know that you have worked with companies large and small and have dealt with security issues across the board. And I know you've got some great things to talk to our guest about.
Well, actually, one of my big questions is some of the material your PR people sent me is alluding to a Forrester consulting survey that you guys did about your customer base. Let's go talk about that. That, you know, there's a lot of variation when you can say customer base, from mom and pop stores up to, you know, large corporation like Disney. What's appropriate for your services?
Yeah, so, you know, I think user experience, and when I say user experience, you can break that down into two primary areas. First would be the user that is using the IT infrastructure. They want transparency, right? Like, they don't want to know about security. They don't want to see a lot of pop-ups. They don't want to see interruptions. They don't want to see friction. And that happens whether you're the smallest, you know, company in the world or if you're the largest company in the world. And so that's consistent. The second component of that is if you think about a large enterprise, they have people that are dealing with sophisticated elements of IT security. They're used to these very complex interfaces that they have to maneuver around and with every time they buy a new security product. What we found is by focusing on the smaller enterprise, they want ease of use. They want ultimately the decision-making of underlying pieces of technology, underlying elements of that stack to be not something they have to think about on a regular basis, and nor candidly do they want to often be involved in that decision making. Now, funny enough, you know, I've done this for now, you know, almost 30 years, primarily around the MSSP MDR space, is all those benefits that you bring to the small business of ease of use and ultimately making it as transparent as possible, but again, ease of utilizing and applying security to their existing IT fabric is actually enjoyed by those largest clients as well. So if you can make a smaller enterprise happy and you can scale and do all the complexity of for a large enterprise, at the end of the day, being able to provide that transparency to the users, the lack of friction, and ultimately that transparency of technology in a way that they don't have to worry about it, but they get all the features and functionalities, is a winning combination there. So that's why we have a spectrum of small businesses as well as large businesses. And if you think about affordability, 24/7, most enterprises that are smaller, so we talked about obviously the 1 to 10 person shop, but even with hundreds or even sometimes thousands of clients, they're not going to go out and staff a $2.5 million SOC operations to run 24/7. One, everything you guys said about training personnel, attracting personnel, those are hard for every company, no matter how big they are. And the smaller they get, obviously, the more critical single threads of individuals become.
Cool. Well, let's go and ask a slightly different question about the market and how it's changed over the last couple of years, or even just changed during the pandemic. A lot of things that, you know, move towards SaaS, you know, software as a service. And obviously folks like Salesforce have been a big driving force in that. But has that changed the MDR world? Has your market changed? Is it pushing further and further down into smaller and smaller companies because you don't need a data center anymore? You can actually run a fairly major operation with everything in the cloud. How has that changed the MDR world?
Yeah, so it's a great question because there has been a significant number of changes. So first of all, a lot of new businesses that have been started over the, let's call it the last 3 years, especially during COVID, are what I'll say, you know, start in the digital world where cloud is their primary delivery mechanism. So they're not going out and building data centers. They're not building, you know, racks and racks of their own compute power in a particular data center environment. They're using cloud. And then more and more, especially during the COVID time, all of those people that were even moving into cloud have moved to SaaS applications that ultimately deliver the same value of having maybe multiple people in IT, you know, manage a mail server, manage SharePoint, manage all of those environmental things that sometimes were set up in the cloud. Now they're completely outsourced altogether. At the same time, existing businesses have accelerated for remote usage, and clearly cloud and clearly those SaaS applications have driven the adoption of many of those early cloud offerings, those SaaS applications, as you mentioned, Salesforce, Office 365, Google Cloud. All of those offerings now have been accelerated, not only by small businesses starting in the cloud, born in the cloud, as we refer to them, but also those larger and mid-sized businesses have pushed more and more applications off of their own environments, off of the cloud, into SaaS applications provided by a lot of these software vendors and now application cloud vendors. And that, and let me finish that. To ultimately, what that means from an MDR player is we need to support those native services. So if you were only looking at the cloud, if you were only looking, obviously, at the customer prem, their PC, those types of applications, you would be blind to what is happening at those SaaS applications. And so more and more, MDR players not only support, as I mentioned before, network, logs, endpoint, but also all those cloud applications that ultimately generate their own activity logs, their own security logs that we have to integrate into that bigger picture across the spectrum of security, risk, and compliance.
Cool. Thanks for a slightly long, great detailed answer, because I was actually doing a fast lookup. I couldn't remember if Salesforce was a sponsor or not. They used to be. Anyway, for our viewers, what kinds of homework should they do before they call you? You know?
Yeah. So our ability to support a client is about understanding the context of that client. And context can go across multiple spectrums. So what is your IT environment supporting that would ultimately be at risk of impacting your revenues? What impact would that have to regulatory compliant? What risk does it provide to human life if you're medical or have autonomous vehicles or anything that might impact human life? And then ultimately, you know, are there mission impacts, you know, if you're a nonprofit, if you're government, that don't always fit into kind of that revenue bucket as well? And so the more we can understand about what criticalities exist within your IT environment, what the dependencies are, what the impact are, the better we would understand. And then also think about, you know, what is it and how is it that you best interact with a service provider as well? So, you know, we're going to ask questions about, you know, hey, we saw this bad thing. We're going to stop it in the middle of the night at 2 a.m., like I used as an example earlier. Do you want us to wake you up anyhow? And in that particular case, understanding kind of the risk tolerance of an organization, what technology stack they have in place, and what that relevant contextual impacts would be are critical elements here. I'll be honest with you. I wish every customer could come to the table thinking about that. But very often they basically come and say, hey, we have a regulatory problem or we have this threat that we're really worried about. Help us. How can you help us? And we're well equipped to be able to do that as well through guiding them through a few quick questions to help understand exactly where their risks are.
Mention it really quickly, regulatory issues. Are your people prepared to deal with GDPR, HIPAA, FERPA, and so forth?
Yeah. So not only are we prepared to have those conversations with clients, understand exactly where those risks are, what the requirements are relative to those regulatory requirements, to take it one step further, we actually go through those compliance requirements ourselves. We also have personnel that are certified. So, for example, we're a PCI QSA, we're a CMMC RPO. We've done HITRUST in the past. We do a lot of HIPAA third-party assessments for clients. We have relationships with auditors where we do SOC 2 prep for clients as well. So very well equipped to have those conversations with clients about exactly what those regulatory compliance requirements are. And then obviously, if they have an outside counsel that has driven some of those conversations, we're very well equipped to interact with them. So we're on, for example, about 15 cyber insurance panels where they bring us in the event of a proactive engagement, help customers do tabletops and make sure that they're set up to have the best defenses. But more often, unfortunately, we're brought in for a cyber insurance firm that has clients that ultimately had a breach. And now we're in a reactive situation and work through reducing that impact of that particular event as well. And then obviously the legal ecosystem that's associated with that as well.
Doug Howard, CEO of Ponderance. We've had a great conversation, but where can our viewers go to go and get more information about your company and about your services and start a conversation?
Yeah, so I think there's two parts. I mean, first of all, you know, a lot of clients hear something like that and they ultimately are afraid to call because they don't know enough to even ask the questions and various other things, as I mentioned before. That's a easy problem to resolve. We're not judgy. We don't ultimately ask a ton of questions that you're going to be uncomfortable with. Our objective is to help you. And honestly, easiest way to engage is just go to Ponderance.com. We have a number of different contact you as well as any of the demos are available online. You can request a conversation and we'll get back with you shortly. So easy click and just give us your name, telephone number, or email. And ultimately, you can see a lot of information and thought leadership online from our website as well at Ponderance.com.
Well, we've been talking with Doug Howard, CEO of Ponderance. Doug, thank you so much for taking the time to be with us today. It sounds like you have a lot on your plate.
Thank you, gentlemen, for having me.
We'd also like to thank my co-host, Brian Chief, for being with us today and asking such great questions. Brian, what do you have coming up for the next week or so?
I'm going to enjoy being retired. Do a lot of reading, try and catch up on, upskilling myself on different things. Right now I'm trying to learn more about, filling some holes in my knowledge on basic electronics. But you know what? One of the cool things I like doing is talking to you, talking to our viewers. You're more than welcome to throw stuff at me on Twitter. My Twitter handle is ADVNETLAB, Advanced Net Lab. And you'd be surprised. One of the things I'm actually talking about, one of the last tweets I did was I put a picture of a document cam, a professional one made by Elmo Corporation. And I'm thinking, gee, there's some really nice cameras out there. Maybe I can go use some LED light strips and go and create a home-built document camera for use at our makerspace and then put it on Instructables, because I'm sure there's a lot of schools out there that would really like document cameras but can't afford the commercial ones. So that'll be fun. You're also more than welcome to throw me email. My email is Cheebert, spelled C-H-E-E-B-E-R-T at twit.tv. You're also welcome to throw email at twit.tv, and that'll hit all the hosts. We'd love to hear from you. And we have viewers everywhere. So don't be afraid. If you're listening and you need to use a translator program and you're willing to send me questions, send it to me in your favorite language. And as long as you don't mind me using a translator program, I'll be more than happy to take a good stab at answering your questions. Just last week, I had someone asking me about fiber optics and things like that. So I will go and talk about just about any enterprise topic you'd like to hear about.
Thank you, Brian. I appreciate you being here, and I appreciate all of our viewers being here as well. Now, as for me, I am, as always, going to be letting you know about what I'm doing at KG4GWA on Twitter. You can also follow me on LinkedIn. You can find me at Dark Reading. Go to darkreading/Omdia. I'm going to be writing there. I would have, frankly, written this week, but I managed to come back from the desert and bring a whole bunch of viruses with me. So I've been wrestling with them this week. I think I'm finally about to declare victory over them. Should be back in the saddle completely next week. Speaking of being back in the saddle next week, all of us here on Twiat will be back in the saddle this time next week. We hope that you will be able to join us at that time as well. Until then, remember, if you want to keep up with all that's great, all that's necessary in the world of enterprise technology, just keep Twiat.
Hey, I'm Rod Pyle, Editor-in-Chief of Ad Astra Magazine, and each week I join with my co-host to bring you This Week in Space, the latest and greatest news from the final frontier. We talk to NASA chiefs, space scientists, engineers, educators, and artists, and sometimes we just shoot the breeze over what's hot and what's not in space books and TV. And we do it all for you, our fellow true believers. So whether you're an armchair adventurer or waiting for your turn to grab a slot in Elon's Mars rocket, join us on This Week in Space and be part of the greatest adventure of all time.